Sad news this week as we learned of the passing of General Thomas Patton Stafford, who flew to space on Gemini 6, Gemini 9, Apollo 10, and the Apollo-Soyuz test project, one of the original greats of spaceflight.
And so to help us pay our respects to the general, we're joined by a fellow Oklahoman, Bill Moore, a wonderful space historian and author who's probably known to a lot of our listeners.
Do you have any special memories of the general? We'd love to hear them. Let us know via our social media pages at Space and Things Podcast on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook, or via the contact form on our website.
But right now, it's time for episode 186 of the Space and Things Podcast.
Space and Things with Dave Giles and Emily Carney. I'm Emily Carney.
And I'm Dave Giles, and welcome to episode 186 of the Space and Things podcast. How are you doing, Emily?
I'm good. How are you doing, Dave?
Not too bad. It was St. Patrick's Day, obviously, over the weekend. And as a musician, that's a busy day. I had 3 gigs, so my voice is still a little bit delicate. You can hear it's still a little bit tired.
See, I didn't hear it.
I know I'm having to use more energy to speak. It's one of those ones, but 6 hours of singing does that.
Woo! Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Let's get started with this week's episode so I don't have to talk as much. Anyway, unfortunately, it is time for another tribute episode, as early on Monday we learnt of the passing of General Thomas P. Stafford, who reached the incredible age of 93.
General Thomas P. Stafford was called to become an astronaut while he was at the prestigious Harvard Business School. According to a 1997 NASA oral history,
"So when there came calls for a second group of astronauts, I applied for it and then went through Air Force screening and then through NASA screening. In the interim, I wanted also to continue my Air Force career. And I always said the Air Force had good technical ability, but their big problem was management. So instead of complaining about it, I wanted to do something positive, and I applied and got one of 3 slots that the Air Force had at Harvard Business School. I'd been there for 3 days and 7 case histories when Deke Slayton called me and said, 'Are you still interested?' I said, 'Absolutely.' And I told him I'd be resigning tomorrow. So I had the notoriety of being the first dropout of the class of 64 at Harvard Business School."
Harvard's loss turned out to be a massive win for the space world, as General Stafford's influence upon NASA, the U.S. Air Force, and the spaceflight community has spanned over 7 decades. Born in Weatherford, Oklahoma on September 17, 1930, the young Stafford graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy with honors in 1952, and shortly after that was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force. Lauded by his colleagues as an incredible pilot, he graduated as the USAF Experimental Test Pilot School's outstanding pupil. According to his NASA biography, he is the co-author of the Pilot's Handbook for Performance Flight Testing and the Aerodynamics Handbook for Performance Flight Testing. Then there's Stafford's spaceflight career, which is the stuff of legend. He was selected to NASA's second astronaut group, the New Nine, on his 32nd birthday. The group was considered by many, including future Group 3 astronaut Michael Collins, as the best astronaut group selected. In December 1965, he and mission commander Wally Schirra conducted the first in-flight rendezvous of 2 crewed spacecraft during the Gemini 6 mission. Their Gemini spacecraft rendezvoused with Gemini 7, crewed by Frank Borman and Jim Lovell. Before that mission left the ground, a few hair-raising moments tested the rookie astronaut. Stafford recounted in the NASA oral history,
"Well, anyway, we got through all the procedures and everything, and we got all set to go, and at T-minus 3 seconds, the engine shut off, and exactly T-zero, they shut down. We still have the all-time record. The shuttle shut down a couple of times, but nothing like we did, and we had the liftoff signal, but we knew in the seat of our pants and all the training we hadn't lifted off. Furthermore, the only one who can call liftoff is a fellow astronaut looking at the base of a booster, you know, on a TV screen. And when he sees first motion, he's the one that can call liftoff. It was Al Bean, and he didn't say a thing. And that's exactly what he should have done, is not say a thing. He didn't see anything."
Schirra's decision not to eject from the vehicle proved correct, and within days, Gemini 6 lifted off successfully to complete its historic mission. 1966's Gemini 9 proved to have a few terrifying moments involving pilot Gene Cernan's torturous EVA, But again, the crew flew a successful mission, returned safely, and pioneered rendezvous techniques required for the Apollo lunar program. May 1969's Apollo 10 reunited Commander Stafford with Cernan, flying as lunar module pilot, and partnered them with command module pilot John W. Young. This mission saw lunar module Snoopy descend to within miles of the lunar surface as a dress rehearsal for the eventual successful lunar landing that took place during July's Apollo 11.
Fast forward to the mid-70s, and NASA was preparing for the last of its Apollo missions, this one serving as a bittersweet swan song to a program rooted in beating the Russians to the moon, the Apollo-Soyuz test project, the first crewed U.S.-Russian spaceflight. This mission was a precursor to later U.S.-Russian space collaborations, including Shuttle Mir and the International Space Station. Stafford then did something a few astronauts were able to do successfully. He returned to his U.S. Air Force career in November 1975. In various leadership roles during his later U.S. Air Force career, Stafford could better put the management skills he learned during his brief time at Harvard to work. He retired from the military in 1979.
Stafford was hardly idle since his NASA and military retirement. He was involved in many space-related decisions throughout the decade, from Hubble Space Telescope surfacing missions to investigating the 2003 Columbia tragedy. He was instrumental in the ISS program and up until recently served as the chairman of the NASA Advisory Task Force on ISS Operational Readiness. In 2004, he published We Have Captured Tom Stafford in the Space Race with Michael Caslet. Moreover, the Stafford Air and Space Museum in Weatherford, Oklahoma is a fantastic tribute to this pioneer's life and career.
And so today, we want to spend some time paying tribute to the general. So we asked Bill Moore to join us to share his thoughts. Bill has served as the president of the Stafford Air and Space Museum Board and has published a book called Oklahomans in Space, Chronicles of the Amazing Contributions of Oklahomans in the Aerospace Industry. This book came about when he was working on an exhibit about Oklahomans in space for the Oklahoma History Center. And that work also yielded a 7-part documentary series on OETA, which is Oklahoma's statewide PBS station. He's been inducted into the Oklahoma Historians Hall of Fame, and some of you may be aware of his recent work with Fred Hayes and his book, Never Panic Early. Anyway, today we're talking with Bill about General Thomas P. Stafford.
Roger, Houston, Apollo 10, you can tell the world that we have arrived.
Thank you, Bill, for coming onto our show on such short notice. First, we'd like to extend our deepest condolences regarding General Stafford's passing. So please tell us about the first time you met the general and your initial impressions of this legendary astronaut.
The first time I met Tom Stafford was at the Oklahoma Air and Space Hall of Fame. I had shaken hands with him before, but to actually sit and visit with him, that was the first time. In Oklahoma, in the late 1960s, there was one place that you could go to learn about space, and that was the planetarium that was at our state fairgrounds. And they would show the NASA films after the mission, those half-hour films that NASA made. And I always made a point to try and, you know, convince someone to drive me there to see him. So obviously, I was familiar with his missions and what he did. And of course, he was always in the newspaper because he was from Oklahoma, and his amazing flights. So he was one of my heroes. I loved everything about space at that time, still do. And General Stafford, I mean, he's the epitome of the astronaut. Mm. In fact, today's paper, front page with the picture and the story about the loss of one of Oklahoma's greatest sons. So he's going to be really missed.
Yeah, that's so good to see that, isn't it? I see a front page news story that it's deserving of that. It winds me up that more of these legends don't get that kind of respect. So I'm glad about that.
So true. He was loved here. You know, a lot of times just say you can't go home, or they don't love you back home, but he was truly loved. And, you know, his hometown of Weatherford, which is about an hour's drive west of Oklahoma City on Interstate 40, he is so loved there. Just everything that he does there. The people are just always, you know, happy to see him, smiling, wanting to visit with him and see how he's doing. And he still has some old classmates there too.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of a side, but I remember on our hipsters field trip a couple of years back, when we went to Weatherford, everything is Tom Stafford, Tom Stafford Street. I thought that was wonderful. I was like, that's really cool because you don't always see that in people's hometowns. Like sometimes you go to people's hometowns and you don't really see anything about them. And it's like, well, that's kind of weird. But I mean, they completely celebrate him. So I love that. I love it.
Gene Cernan, you know, one of his best buddies, when he would come here, he would always make a point to say there are more statues of Tom Stafford in Oklahoma than Will Rogers.
It's true. Absolutely. So before becoming an astronaut in 1962, Stafford was known as one of the nation's brightest, most courageous test pilots. So what set him apart as a test pilot in a community of other men, you know, doing similar things?
Probably his intelligence. Anyone you talk to or anything you see about Tom Stafford, they talk about how brilliant he was. There is a video program that Seagate's executive, Tom Lusso, made. And they interviewed a lot of the astronauts in that program for General Stafford. And they talk about, you look at the mission control people like Chris Kraft. Kraft talks about him like he was the most brilliant thing with the slide rule. And so if you get that kind of praise from Chris Kraft, that tells you what kind of man he was.
Absolutely. So many space enthusiasts are familiar with General Stafford's spaceflight career, but perhaps aren't as familiar with his Air Force career. One of our patrons, John Wisenhunt, has asked the following question regarding this. He said, General Stafford was one of the few astronauts back in the day who went back to their military service after NASA. He was obviously very successful, but did he ever share why he chose that path rather than a more lucrative job in the private sector?
No, I never talked to him about that. I did ask him something similar to that. I asked him if he had stayed as an active astronaut after Apollo 10, wouldn't he have landed on the moon, walked on the moon, because both of the other two guys on that mission commanded a moon landing mission. And he said, yeah, but it's more important in life to be a general than to walk on the moon. And so he said, the path I took in management is what made the rest of my career and my life successful. So that's probably going along with what you're asking. He probably decided that, he wanted to work as a general in the Air Force. And I mean, obviously, look at that career. Not only did he oversee Edwards and Area 51, but after that, he was at the Pentagon. And, he was head of technology. And my goodness, what amazing technology came out of that.
Yeah, it strikes me. In Emily's obituary about Tom, it said about how he was, before he was an astronaut, he was at Harvard Business School trying to learn management because he thought that the management in the Air Force sucked. And he wanted to do something about it. So I suppose it was written on the stars, well, pardon the pun, before he even joined NASA, that he was going to go down that route, wasn't it?
I think so. It's hard to say what happens with each individual's life, but in his case, you could kind of see that track. And yeah, everything about his Navy, Air Force, astronaut years, post-astronaut years, and then in post-Air Force years, look at what he did. It's just astounding the career he had.
Absolutely. So General Stafford's last spaceflight was the 1975 Apollo Soyuz test project. Now, this was really as significant as a moonwalk for NASA and the United States regarding international relations with the Soviet Union. Tell us what this represented, you know, how it influenced spaceflight, and most touchingly, Stafford's continued friendship with Soyuz commander Alexei Leonov.
He was a very important person in Russia and before that in the Soviet Union. All the work he did, he kind of opened up the communist country to what America was about. And this was something they really had not seen before. No one had been let in their country and open to conversation, and they got to know him and to know what Americans were like. So he really did cross that bridge, and he actually made the bridge and crossed it. But when you look at the work he did in Russia, the work he did to begin with on the Apollo Soyuz test project, a lot of people say this is the guy who began the melting of the Cold War. And it was because of that exposure to what Americans were like, and his, you know, his friendship with Alexei Leonov was a big part of that. And those two guys, they were like brothers. And I love a picture I saw the other day on social media of the two of them. They were, I think they were at Sochi, and they were in a sled together having a good time. But you see a lot of pictures of them like that, fishing or hunting or whatever. They just had a great time. So this human aspect of what he brought to space travel, it really led the way. Not only did we do that flight in 1975, but it led the way to our cooperation on Mir, and then to the cooperation on building the International Space Station. And look at today. My goodness, we've got such a problem with each other, with Russia and America. But look, we're still working together on the space station, and they don't have any problems up there.
Yep, that's absolutely right. As an aside, I just read we have capture last night by Stafford and Michael Cassatt. And I was struck at how much he did to melt the Cold War. Like, I honestly don't think I really understood that until I read that book. So just incredible work that all happened behind the scenes that he was doing. So General Stafford was active in his, quote, retirement years, and until recently was active in the International Space Station matters. So why do you think he never truly retired?
You could probably tell by just watching, but if you knew the man, you know he would never retire. There was no quit in that guy. Really amazing what he could accomplish in a short time. When he would fly into Oklahoma, I'd pick him up at the airport, and I'd drive him out to Weatherford. And a lot of times he'd be on the phone, and he'd be talking to a congressman or someone in Russia, a corporate manager somewhere. He was constantly working the phones, and it was very impressive, the company he kept too. So yeah, that just tells you right there, he was on the go, on the move, and still, you know, into his 90s, he was still doing that. John Harrington, the STS-113 astronaut, was involved in an IMAX film. He was kind of the star of an IMAX film, and they had the premiere at the National Air and Space Museum. And this was like just a couple of weeks before COVID shut the country down. And John invited me to come to the premiere. And so on a whim, I called General Stafford, and I knew he made trips to Washington periodically. And I said, are you in DC? He says, matter of fact, I am. I said, would you like to come see? Cause I knew in the evening, you know, he wouldn't be busy on the Hill. So I said, would you like to come see a premiere of this film with John? And he said, yeah, at the Space Museum. I said, yep. So there he was when we pulled up. There he was waiting, getting out of the taxi. And it was a great event. It was a filled room there in the National Air and Space Museum Theater. And they introduced General Stafford, and it was just a standing ovation. People just loved him.
Fantastic.
Wow. That is amazing. That is awesome to hear. Yeah, I love how you're like, yeah, he's on the phone with Russia, as one is with Russia, as one is, like, he's just wheeling and dealing, you know. That's so awesome. Yeah. So,
you know, he was still on a lot of committees, not only here in, with NASA, but he was chairing committees with Russia. And I think that NASA and probably the president's office probably used him whenever they need to communicate about some kind of space problem or something they needed to do work on of the space station. I think he was still doing all of that.
Wow.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. So you're the Oklahoma expert in spaceflight, and General Stafford was an icon in Weatherford, his hometown. We've talked a little bit about in this interview about how there's literally statues and streets everywhere, every corner that are named after him. So do you have any favorite memories or stories about, you know, Stafford, the man that you'd like to share with us?
Probably the most enjoyable time with him would be when he would have a lot of his buddies here for an event. Like if we had the 40th anniversary of Apollo 10 or the 30th and then the 40th of Apollo Soyuz. And we even had a 80th birthday party for him out at the museum. And he would invite all of his astronaut buddies. So we'd have most of the Apollo guys here, you know, whenever that would happen. And he would show them around the museum. And of course, first couple of times he'd give tours and give in-depth information. But as it went on in time, he would just show them what was new and talk about what was coming and that kind of thing. And it was always fun to hear their comments, because you would hear like Gene Cernan ask, well, where did you get all this stuff, Tom? Al Bean would, you know, he'd be talking about some kind of diameter of the engine he'd give the millimeters of the stroke and all that stuff. And Al Bean would say, your memory is unbelievable. And to watch these
nuts.
Guys, they just, you could tell there was a lot of admiration for him. Yeah. That was probably my favorite, just watching him walk with those guys around the museum and talk.
Yeah, that must be special. Let's briefly talk about the museum. You were president of the board, I believe, for a time. Emily and I have both been there, not together. It's a wonderful place. And you're right, Gene Cernan was right. Where did he get all that stuff from? Because there's so much great stuff in there. But for me, it's the personal things. For example, there's a bottle of, is it vodka or whiskey? That's got a connection between him and Alexei Leonov. And it's those kind of things that just make it really stand out. It's very much his museum, isn't it?
It really is. And he wanted to use it to tell the story of aviation leading up to the space program and then the story of the space program. And, you know, we have a gallery of early airplanes and whatnot, but then you get into the later aviation jets and the Meg, and you look at that stuff, and he flew every one of those.
Yeah.
Every jet, every later model airplane in that museum is something he flew, and that's just a part of what he flew. The list is just long and amazing. The early aircraft in there, when he takes tours through there, he would tell the details about them as if he had flown them and knew them. So his mind, it was just an amazing, amazing thing to listen to. And that video I was talking about, Chris Crabb saying something about his thought process. Chris said that during Gemini 6, when they were doing the rendezvous, that Stafford was up there doing the calculations with his slide rule while on the ground NASA was doing with the computers, and they'd read the results up to Stafford, and he'd check them with what he found, and he'd say, hey, you're right. So Chris Crabb, you could tell he really admired Stafford, and he said in that program that this was the flight that made Stafford, was the rendezvous in space.
I can't believe he was doing all that on a slide rule. That is wild to me. I'm like, that guy was a brainiac for real. I mean, that's nuts. That's nuts. Okay. I'm kind of blown away. As somebody who was in the military and had to use math on a lot of occasions, I'm like, how did he freaking do this? Okay.
I know.
So I want to ask you, and this will be our last question. What do you think General Tom Stafford's, I want to add that, what do you think his legacy will be?
For Oklahoma, Tom Stafford's legacy is that, as we've talked about, he was this great, brilliant man who accomplished amazing things. But he was, to you, to individuals who came up to him and talked to him, he was the most gentle, unbelievably friendly guy that you could ever come upon. And we started as a board about four or five years ago. We started a project called the Legacy Project, and this was to honor General Stafford. And we've redone the entire museum so that the outside is amazing and the inside is even more amazing. And we're redoing all of the exhibits. We're in the middle of that right now. And it's going to turn into, it's like a Smithsonian on the prairie. So nice. wonderful bookend to the Cosmosphere. So I think his legacy is partially that museum, but it's mostly just him as a human being.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Bill, and sharing your stories with us. These interviews and these episodes are never easy to do, but I think we've given people a good taste of what the General was all about. So thank you very much for that.
Yes.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's been my honor. Thank you.
One thing I wanted to say about General Stafford, I want to make it clear I was not very close to him, but I did meet him a few times at, you know, various space events, because he, as Bill said during the interview, he was very active in the space community. This was somebody who really never retired. And my impressions of him were he was a total gentleman. I was honestly very intimidated the first time I saw him because he's got that military bearing. I just made a sort of a military, like, you know, tough guy face. He kind of has that thing about him where he's, you know, really, you know, old school tough Air Force guy. And when I talked to him, that just went away completely. He was very polite, very, very talkative, very funny. I found, like, he would make sort of jokes and stuff. But one of the best memories I have of him was it was the Skylab. Of course, it was Skylab. It was the 40th anniversary event for the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, and Stafford was there. And I was sitting with a friend of mine. I was like, "Oh, Tom Stafford's at the next table." And he's like, "Oh, yeah, he's everywhere." And I was like, "What?" So and I didn't bother him during the event because he was, you know, he was holding court at his table and all this stuff. I remember at the end of the event, I was walking on the bus and I looked next to me and who is there but General Tom Stafford. Like, I think he noticed me looking at him sort of like, and he was like, "Oh yeah, you know, this was an awesome event. Skylab was an amazing program." And we actually had a decent chat for a couple minutes. And at first I was like, am I alive? Like, is this real? You know, I'm talking to freaking General Tom Stafford. But he couldn't have been just nicer and just more normal. And he was a gentleman. There was nothing intimidating about him. So I have very warm memories of him, and I'm very sad about his passing. I know these guys are in their 90s. I know people don't live forever, obviously, but I'm very sad about it. I feel like it's truly the end of an era with this passing, because he was just such a legend. And this was somebody, as Bill said so beautifully in our interview, this is somebody who never quit. This is somebody who was active up until the very end. And he shaped so much of space flight. I mean, I don't think we really can wrap our heads around how much he did during his lifetime and even during his last decade, when a lot of people would be, you know, going fishing and stuff like that. So
I like that part of the interview where Bill told us that he would still work it, like when the presidents needed him to make a phone call about something, particularly with Russia, perhaps they would get General Tom Stafford to make the call. I thought that was amazing. Like that's how much respect he had, even in his 80s, real late on in his life, they still respected him so much to say the person that you get to talk to Russia is Tom Stafford. He is the person they respect and will listen to him. I mean, that's huge. And how do you replace someone like that?
Exactly.
Who now becomes that person? Because that's tough, isn't it?
Yeah. Who is going to be that person now? I'm not sure, you know, as I said in the interview, last night I stayed up all night and read We Have Captured, Stafford's autobiography he did with Michael Cassatt. And I am embarrassed I slept on that book for so many years and did not read it. It is spectacular because he's the guy. Like, he is literally the guy who made the ISS possible. I mean, this is the man. Mm. And when I'm reading it, I'm like, he's gone. Can anybody fill that spot now? Is it even possible for anybody to fill that spot? Yeah, that's honestly what I'm concerned about. There's that part of me that's like, I feel like a whole era has just ended just now. What's also weird is yesterday I was talking to a few people. Vance Brand is his last surviving crew member, which is crazy to me. Just crazy.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the last guy. Last guy standing of all his crews. I guess the occupational hazard of loving guys in their 80s and 90s. I don't know. I mean, I'm very personally sad about Stafford, even though I was not close to him. But just, you know, to me, it represents the passing of an entire era.
There's another last man standing as well, though, isn't there? You also have the last of the new nine being Jim Lovell now.
Yeah, right?
That group of astronauts was a phenomenal group of astronauts. You know, you go through the names of those guys and you know, Borman, Conrad, Armstrong, Young, Tom Stafford, Ed White. You know, it's an incredible group.
These guys did everything. I mean, these guys incredible did everything group. From the Gemini program, if that's how you like to say it. These guys did everything from Gemini to shuttle. I mean, that's a lot, and that's a very long period of time. These guys had an enormous influence, and I can't believe Lovell's the only guy left. I mean, it's sobering to me.
Yeah, which is really crazy. It just really gets you thinking, doesn't it? I mean, it's so sad. It's so sad that we're coming to the end of that era.
Yeah.
I'm really glad we spoke to Bill. I mean, he really is the Oklahoma expert, isn't he? He's certainly the man. I hope we get him back to talk about the book he's currently writing with John Harrington. I think that would be really interesting to speak
Absolutely.
To him more about that. So I think that we'll hear more from Bill. I'm sure we will. Anyway, for those of you who are in our Patreon group, you can watch that interview unedited on patreon.com. Go to patreon.com/spaceandthings. And if you'd like to know more about Bill and what he's up to, please check the show notes and we'll put some links in there for you.
Apollo Houston, I got two messages for you. Moscow is go for docking. Houston is go for docking. It's up to you guys. Have fun.
All righty, sounds good.
So, Emily, what has caught your eye in spaceflight this week?
This week, NASA announced, and this is from an article from scientificamerican.com, NASA announced that they completed a significant step in breaking through to the Voyager 1 spacecraft. As you guys have known through the previous podcast, in the last few months, NASA and JPL have been unable to communicate properly with Voyager 1. Basically, it's been sort of sending sort of gibberish back to Earth, which is not good. And the problem was traced back to a computer issue with the spacecraft. So in positive news, though, NASA announced that they managed to decode a portion of the spacecraft's, and this is from the article by Nadia Drake, gobbledygook, allowing them to maybe find a way to see what the spacecraft is trying to say. So Joe Westlake, director of NASA's Heliophysics Division, which is overseeing the mission, said this is an excellent development. Voyager 1 and its sister spacecraft, Voyager 2, have been in space since fall 1977. Technically, they're around the same age as I am, 46, 47-ish. So I know when I'm having an increasingly harder time getting out of bed in the morning because things are starting to hurt a little bit more. So it's amazing that Voyager 1 and 2 are even trucking on as well as they are. So that positive development has been made. The article does kind of mention, though, these issues have sort of brought to light that eventually these missions are going to have to come to an end at some point.
Yeah.
You know, of course, the spacecraft are going to continue to go through interstellar space. We're just not going to be able to talk to them. So anyway, So some positive developments in that story this week. And of course, I'll keep you informed, you all informed of any other further developments regarding the Voyager program, which is still going after a very, very long time. So Dave, what's caught your eye this week?
Just one thing. Starship.
Yes. I knew you were going to talk about it, so I wanted to give you the best one. Yeah, that was insane. Yes.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, how could you have missed it? It was even on the front pages of some newspapers over here. Starship has made it to space. It got up there, seemed to be pretty good launch, made it all the way around towards Australia before it was due to come back into the atmosphere, and then there was some malfunctions. I believe that's how it went. I haven't had too much time to read the follow-up stuff of exactly what they think has happened, but I watched the launch as it was happening, and it was such a cool thing to watch. Some of the views we got from the spacecraft were amazing.
Yeah,
they're so good with cameras, aren't they? They really do get that kind of stuff right.
Oh, they're good nowadays with that. Yeah, that nowadays they're good with that. You didn't see that during the Apollo days. It would have been cool if you'd seen it, but they just didn't have that back then.
Well, yeah, the way it worked, didn't they have some for the launch? The famous launch stuff you see on board cameras for the Apollo program was mostly from Apollo 4, I believe. And it was a camera that was mounted in the instrument unit inside, and then they dropped it through the atmosphere and I had to fish it out the ocean. And I think there was a camera lost as well, so that we could have had some more.
And they had to develop.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they had to develop the film. It wasn't like they had, you know, an instantaneous live view.
Absolutely.
Like they did for Starship,
yeah,
which was wild. I was like, how is this happening? This is crazy.
It
this
really
is
was.
Nuts.
So that was really worth watching. That was just wonderful. And to be honest, Emily, I'm quite glad that I haven't been online much, because I'm sure, based on how things normally go with Starship, the people like to jump on one way or the other of the extremes of praise or the opposite of that. Having a go at Elon.
It's been...
I can't imagine what it was like in Hipsters.
It was nuts.
Yeah, but...
It was nuts. That's all you need to know.
I don't think you can see every... This is the third time we've seen one of these, and there's been progress, good, huge progress from each one of the launches, from one to the next. And they've got four stacked, ready to go, I believe. So it fills me with a little bit of hope about the future of the Artemis landing program and other things that were supposed to be, they're all delayed, but we can now see some glimmers of hope that this might be happening. They might actually get this thing going soon.
But it honestly fills me with some hope for humanity as well, because we're finally going to be able to hopefully go to deep space.
Absolutely.
You know, and get the hell off the Earth if we have to. So I think that is really cool.
Absolutely.
10, 9, we have ignition sequence start. Engines on, 5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running. Launch commit, liftoff. We have liftoff 49 minutes past the hour.
Right, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us once again. These kind of episodes are always difficult for us, but the General certainly deserved a full episode devoted to him and his achievements.
Yes, thank you very much for listening and for all of your support. But don't forget, in space, no one can hear you me.
This has been the Space and Things Podcast with Emily Carney and Dave Giles.